these failures do bother me. I love talking about them, and I do see them as badges to a great degree, because I've failed at things that the vast majority of people wouldn't even attempt.
Diz Runs Radio, episode 519, starts in 3, 2. Welcome back to Diz Runs Radio, where I talk with runners from all corners of the running world about running, life, and everything in between. I'm your host, Denny Cray, and it's just about time to head out the door for an easy run and a great conversation. So if you're ready, then I'm ready. Let's get started. Hey guys, real quick before we dive into today's conversation, just want to let you know or remind you or tell you, whatever the case might be, that if you're struggling with something running related and you're not really sure exactly how to proceed, whether it's injury related, whether it's training related, preparing for a race, whatever it might be, if you think that you would benefit from, you know, a little bit of coaching, but maybe not, you know, full scale coaching, but just a conversation with a coach. One of the things that I do offer are consultation calls where you can just, you know, schedule a call. It costs you, you know, 20 bucks, something like that. And, you know, we jump on the phone for 20, 30 minutes and help you work through whatever struggle, problem, issue that you're currently dealing with, you know, whatever that might be. We'll try to give you some clarity and some next steps and some things that you can do to move forward. So, if you find yourself kind of at a little bit of an impasse, and you're not sure what to do, head over to dizruns.com/consultation. And, you know, we can schedule something up and figure it out, or at least help you figure it out. At least that's the idea. But anyway, without any further ado, let's dive into today's episode of the show. Hey guys, over the years, I've had a lot of great conversations with people that are really, I mean, always pushing their boundaries and blowing my mind with what they are capable of doing. And today's guest is really one of those folks that is always up to something incredible, and typically something that no one has done before. That's kind of his thing. The first time he was on the show, we talked a lot about his enjoyment for FKTs, which are fastest known times, and the OKTs, which is the original known time. So again, doing something that no one has done before. We talked about how he strives to push his boundaries, and not only his boundaries, but just the boundaries of what is possible for human endurance as well. The second time he was on the show, we talked about his love for the 200-mile race, which is just mind-blowing in and of itself, dealing with rough patches during some of his adventures and races and journeys that he's been on. And also, we had a little tease about a stint on a reality show that he was on shortly after we chatted. But now he's back for another go-round, so round three. And I know there are going to be another batch of great stories and valuable lessons that all of us can relate to, whether you're a 200-mile runner or not. And so without any further ado, it's a pleasure to welcome my friend Ross Vaughn back to the show. Thanks for joining us again, Ross. Really appreciate it. Looking forward to it today.
Hey, blessings, Denny. It's great to be with you again. I always enjoy talking to you.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'm sure we're going to have a little fun, hopefully a lot of fun. But before we get too far into the weeds, just want to let everybody know where they can find you if they want to, you know, follow along, because following along with your adventures is always a worthy pastime and something that it's always a joy for me to see something from you flash across my feed on various social media accounts. So ultrapedestrian.com, ULTRA, ultrapedestrian.com is the website, main hub of everything, blog posts and links and all the good stuff there. On the Facebook, you can find him there, facebook.com/Jahsonites, JAHSONITES. On the Twitter, on the Instagram, same handle both places, and actually the same as the website URL there, at Ultra Pedestrian. And the YouTube channel is Ultra Pedestrian Channel, all one word. And you can find them in all of those places. And again, it's worth adding to your feed and enjoying the stories and the journey that him and his wife Kathy are on and usually together. And if you want to check out the past episodes of our earlier two conversations, the first one was episode 76. So dizruns.com/076 to head to the show notes and listen to the episode there. And dizruns.com/377 was our round two, just about a year ago at this time. So, a year later, and now now the show notes for this episode and links to everything that we've talked about in the past and whatever we talk about today, dizruns.com/519. So, now that all of that mouthful of fun stuff is out of the way, Ross, I mean, you've been here a couple of times. You know the drill. We always ask the same question, so I'm going to ask it again, but I don't know if the answer is going to change or not. If not, I've got another question that I want to ask if the answer tends to be the same. But we'll just start out the same way as we always do. What is your favorite distance to race and why?
My favorite distance race, you know, I know the question's coming, and it still kind of catches me off guard just in being ready to actually give you an answer, because it's so hard for me to narrow it down. The 200 mile distance is still just really fascinating to me. That's kind of the ultimate distance for a supported race or a supported run, you know, where it makes the most sense to me to have some support, because I can really easily do a 50K unsupported. You know, even a 50 miler without support isn't a big deal. 100 miles takes a little more planning, but I can do it. But 200 is really kind of an interesting, I don't know, maybe not a sweet spot, but a sour spot. Just, you know, just a really challenging distance where it makes sense to make use of that race infrastructure support to do something unique. It's a distance where I can really notice the difference that support makes. I can cover 200 miles much more quickly in a supported format than I can unsupported or self-supported. So I think that still is kind of a fascinating distance for me, especially if I'm thinking in that supported race paradigm or that sort of approach. Mm-hmm. Although last year, or this year, 2017, I only did two organized races. One was a 50K, and the other one was actually my first road marathon, which I'd never run a road marathon. I really never intended to. It wasn't a hard and fast rule. I just didn't, you know, I don't find a lot intriguing about road. It doesn't engage me all that much. So I had just kind of never planned on it, but, during one of my recent adventures when I was in South Africa, I was walking around Durban and saw flyers, posters for a marathon, and looked over to my left and actually saw the sign up for it happening just a couple days ahead of time. You know, especially like road marathon culture is a bit outside my experience. I've seen coverage in magazines and stuff, but hadn't actually been to, let alone run in a road marathon. And just seemed like too propitious a thing to have stumbled upon and not participate in. So I ended up running the township to township marathon in Durban, South Africa. My first road marathon, had a blast, and ended up qualifying for Comrades. I didn't even know it was a Comrades qualifier. So.
Wow. And that's why I don't pass up the opportunity to ask that question. Cause I, as much as I followed and I tried to follow along with what was going on the Africa trip, which I definitely want to get into a lot more of that adventure in a minute. But I missed that part of the road marathon. So you said you enjoyed it. And obviously from knowing you for a little while and having some other conversations, you know, and something that I know we did talk about at one point back, you know, one of the previous two was the difference between kind of or what you enjoy about the trail culture. What was you said you enjoyed the marathon in South Africa. You think you'll do another one at some point, or was it probably a one and done for you?
I actually, at this point, I would say I'm pretty positive that I'll do another one. It'll probably be in similar circumstances. Mm-hmm. Where there'll just have to be something really interesting and engaging about it, which, you know, which they're running from one township to another through Durban. I mean, that's something that you wouldn't necessarily get to do. It's not something you could do outside of the race format. I mean, it used a lot of roads, many of which were closed, including part of the highway, you know, so it's not something you could do outside of that race format. And it just was a great experience, really fun, a really unique opportunity. I'll give you a little teaser for when we talk about the Africa trip here. I was going to run another marathon about a week later when I was in Madagascar, because they had the Tana International Marathon happening and there were still registrations available. So I was actually going to do my second road marathon a month later in a different country, but it was canceled due to the plague outbreak.
Oh, Well, that's a good reason, I suppose, to cancel a race, right?
I guess they had supposedly canceled all public gatherings, but in the capital in Antananarivo. But I still saw a bunch of public gatherings like almost every day. So I don't know, but they canceled it. It does seem like an important reason, and in my limited experience with road marathons, I can't remember ever hearing of another one being canceled due to the plague.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe that's one of those things we take for granted here in the States and some of the more modernized, westernized countries. Is that that there's reasons that races get canceled, but the plague is usually not one of the ones that we're worried about.
Right. Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, in an average year, there's something like between 20 and 30 plague deaths in Madagascar throughout the year, and some my numbers could be checked with Google, but I think it was 2015. There were 15 or 17 deaths in the U.S. from plague. Really? So it's actually, yeah, it's not that big a difference. There's plague in the U.S. It's in prairie dog populations in the Southwest and a few other places, and people get exposed to it the same way they've always gotten exposed to plague, which is the fleas from rodents biting them. So, but what had happened in Madagascar this year is when you get bit by a flea with the plague, you get bubonic plague, which is what everybody's used to hearing about. If that goes untreated in some individuals, it'll move into the lungs and it becomes pneumonic plague, where it can then be expressed and transmitted, through sneezing and coughing.
Yeah,
yeah, it can become transmitted through airborne contaminants. So that was what was a big deal, was they were concerned about the pneumonic form moving into the big population center of the capital, because usually it's the bubonic form and it's a few scattered cases out in the rural areas.
So. Yeah. Yeah. It's any of those airborne pathogens. Yeah. You get a bunch of people together, whether it's running or anything. I mean, shoot, you just get a bunch of people together and that's when outbreaks happen, and we obviously try to avoid those as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
So, let's just go ahead and dive into this Africa adventure that you went on, since we've kind of teased at it a couple times and mentioned it a couple times. I'll be honest, I didn't go back and do too much research and reminding myself of exactly what the plan was, but, where did, you know, knowing you, there was something there that you've been probably working on for a while and kind of all of, obviously the logistics and all that kind of stuff that was going into it. But what was the purpose of the trip to Africa, other than the chance to go to Africa, which I think all of us would jump at? But I got to assume that there was more to it than that. So let's just start at the beginning. Why head to where were you? South Africa, Madagascar, and Lesotho, I think, were the three places?
Yeah, South Africa, Madagascar, and Lesotho.
Lesotho. Okay, so what was going on? Why were you heading there?
Well, I mean, at a sort of foundational level, just like you said, who wouldn't jump at the chance to go to Africa? Just in every level that resonates with me, you know, in such an intense way, with my fascination with our sort of animal history as human beings, of being hominids and bipeds, that is obviously where we came from. Being a Rastafari, the idea of having that trip of repatriation, of visiting the homeland of Africa where all human beings came from, just all of those levels, obviously. The specifics of this trip, you know, without getting into too much of it, basically somebody approached me about doing an adventure in Africa, and we went through a bunch of months of planning, and then some other things played out, and kind of at the last minute, it turned out that it became really obvious that it wasn't going to work for us to do this adventure together. So basically, through this whole kind of crazy series of circumstances, I ended up on a plane to South Africa without a real solid plan. So basically, that was the time that I was going to be using for planning my Madagascar adventure, and instead that ended up being the time that I had to replan the whole Africa, or the whole South Africa and the Lesotho adventure, from the ground up. So so just, you know, I try to approach life sort of like an improv comedy class. You know, when you watch those improv shows and stuff, part of what they teach you is to always say yes. When mm-hmm. you're playing a character and the person across from you says this crazy thing, you kill the whole scene if you confront it with logic or if you say no. But if you say yes and then you roll with it, the whole scene keeps playing out. And without things getting too crazy, I try to approach life like that. So basically, I had this crazy scene I was in and I just kept saying yes. And even though things didn't go the way I had foreseen or originally planned or hoped for them to go, it ended up with me landing in Johannesburg with a whole bunch of gear and ambitions, but not real solid plans.
So, all right. So that's obviously, you know, for anybody, months of training, preparation, getting ready to go, and then all of a sudden life happens, curveball, time to readjust. So once you got to Johannesburg, how did things unfold from there?
From there it was really overwhelming. Johannesburg is a kind of intense seeming city, and I'm not much of a city guy anyway. I enjoy a metropolitan area for a day or two, and then I'm pretty worn out and I need some not only physical but mental space, you know. So I have a limited endurance as far as dealing with the really urban situation. And then Johannesburg is just really kind of a crazy city. I was in a few different neighborhoods. I wasn't in the sort of artsy neighborhood or anything like that and didn't get to experience that. But I spent a few days, you know, walking around, getting supplies, doing the stuff I needed to do, and just moving through these intense streets, you know, where everything has big high walls and razor wire and electric wires across the top and big automated gates. I mean, there's a really, you know, sort of militarized feel to the suburbs around Johannesburg, which was just something I had never experienced before. Mm-hmm. So that was intense, and that was kind of overwhelming. But within a couple of days, I had an Airbnb booked there, and the woman was really cool, this woman, Brenda, and she has a crazy amount of knowledge of Africa because she was an overlander, has like a 4x, you know, with a camping setup. And that's part of how people enjoy wild areas in Africa is these overlanding trips, because there's just tons and tons of savanna where you can kind of go and drive everywhere. And it's been, you know, inhabited and impacted by people for thousands and thousands of years. It's not like wilderness in the US where you can go someplace and see, you know, be surrounded by miles and miles of forest, and you can at least trick yourself into thinking that no human being has ever stood in that place before. But Africa, there's not that illusion. There's kind of people everywhere. Hmm. So anyway, Brenda was really experienced with that. And so I was able to talk to her about a lot of things just in general and get a lot of guidelines from her. And I, of course, knew of the Drakensberg Grand Traverse as being an epic hiking and navigating route in South Africa. I thought it actually turns out it is mostly in Lesotho,
okay,
which was great because that was one of the places I really wanted to explore and adventure in and have an experience of was the kingdom in the sky, Lesotho. It's the highest nation on earth. I think everywhere, the entire country is above 1,000 meters in elevation. Really, really unique place. So that was sort of the focus that my mind ended up centering on was the Drakensberg Grand Traverse. And with my predilection for being a little bit slow, you know, I'm just speed-wise, I'm not in the upper end of the game as far as FKTs go. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying to look to do something different, do an only known time, do something that hasn't been done. And so I started looking at the Drakensberg Grand Traverse with that in mind, and had just applied kind of my standard approach of trying to yo-yo it, with the idea being to experience the route as completely as possible. There was a two-man team that had yo-yoed the route, so done it once in each direction, the previous January, so January of 2017, but they had not done it in a purely unsupported, according to a purely unsupported ethic. So they had had accompaniment on the second trip, and I think they used some of the infrastructure at Sani Pass when a big storm hit them. So that was the goal I took on, was trying to do a purely unsupported double Drakensberg Grand Traverse. That was what my mind eventually latched onto. And once my brain sinks its teeth into an adventure, then that's pretty much it. Then it just turns into figuring out the logistics and giving it a go.
Gotcha. When you got there and you know that became kind of what the default plan B almost was. Again, without going into too many specifics on what the original plan was and that ended up falling through, was it close enough to this? I mean, I'm going to assume that it was close enough to the same thing that the gear that you had, that the supplies that you had with you were able to translate to the different adventure, or did was that part of the factor of reconfiguring and figuring out, all right, how are we going to adjust now because I don't have necessarily the proper gear that I would have brought if this was plan A to begin with?
I basically had everything that I needed to do it. I basically headed to Africa with all of my adventure running gear and nearly 2 months worth of dehydrated food. I took a bunch of dehydrated refried beans and instant rice and these soy strips that we flavor up and dehydrate at home, and a bunch of trail butter and some honey stinger bars and waffles. So I had everything that I needed to be adventuring pretty much the whole time that I was there. Okay. So it was perfect that way, as I could take as much, you know, as I needed to do what I was attempting. And the only stuff that I had to buy locally were things that were hard to fly with, or that, you know, that I like batteries that I didn't want exposed to the cold temperature in the cargo hold, 'cause it would sap some of their charge. So I bought batteries in South Africa, and, pepper spray, I think, was the only other thing I really, really bought, just because of the some of the dogs. I'd been warned about wild dogs in Lesotho, so I bought a canister of pepper spray, which, you know, I didn't want to try to fly with something like that, just not knowing.
yeah, that's a hard one to talk yourself out of, even if you had a very legitimate reason to have it. That's a hard one to wiggle out of if something were to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
So Grand Drakensberg, is that my phrasing that right?
Yeah, Drakensberg Grand Traverse.
Drakensberg Grand Traverse. How did it go? I know a little bit that it didn't necessarily go quite as planned, but how did that attempt play out for you?
Yeah, it didn't go as planned, but I mean, that's just sort of what you expect, you know. I mean, that's almost the default. I always say that it's not an adventure until something goes wrong. So, this trip was an adventure before I even got there, right? I ended up just completing a single traverse. I wasn't able to do the double, it was a typhoon that came close to South Africa off the coast of Durban. So this big storm hit, and it actually knocked out the power and internet from Durban all the way up to the Drakensberg, which is quite a ways. And just this crazy weather came in and basically soaked me and all of my gear. And it was to the point where if the weather had stopped and the sun had come out, I could have easily dried everything and turned around, because I was basically nearing the south end. I was nearing my turnaround point. But the weather didn't improve. It just continued to deteriorate. And then it ended up being just horrible for the next couple of days. It was like really serious weather. And this situation is that you've basically got savanna. You've got this low flat land all the way from the coast until it hits the Grand Escarpment. And then the Grand Escarpment, which is basically where the Drakensberg is, the land jumps up to between 10 and 11,000 feet all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So you get, weather coming in across the savanna, and then it hits the high pressure system over this huge escarpment and develops very, very quickly. So you get really sudden onset of intense weather, which is what the Drakensberg is known for. I mean, it's famous for it. And I was prepared. I wasn't in a life-threatening situation by a long shot. I had all the gear that I needed to survive a couple days of inclement weather, but I didn't have enough gear to continue moving for multiple days of extreme weather.
Right, right. So,
so
at that point, you just kind of just said, "This, we're done. Can't go. Can't keep doing this anymore."
Yeah, I hiked down into Bushman's Neck, which was supposed to be my bounce point where I would have turned around and headed back for the second yo of the yo-yo. And I mean, I wanted to. I thought it through. I mean, I agonized over the decision. I mean, this was the culmination, you know, of a couple of weeks of planning at that point, on top of months of other of additional planning before everything had really taken this specific shape and investment and all of that. But it was a ridiculous decision. It would have been a really imprudent decision to head back up to, you know, 10,000 plus feet of elevation with sopping wet gear with no change in weather in sight. And again, this was in Lesotho and South Africa. So this was on a foreign continent, you know, in foreign countries. I didn't have friends I could call for help. I didn't have a cell signal the vast majority of the time. I didn't have good maps. There just aren't great digital maps available of Lesotho because I searched for those for months ahead of time. So I just didn't know. I didn't know bailout points. There weren't a lot of them. If it had been the North Cascades, you know, if it had been Washington, right, if it had been the Pinaleno Mountains in Arizona, you know, if it had been any place that I was familiar with, I would have risked it. I would have at least turned around and headed back up high and as suffered one more horribly miserable night if I had the possibility of bailouts. But in this circumstance, I really didn't. I didn't know what my possibilities were, and I didn't feel that I could take maybe that little bit of risk that I would have taken otherwise. So I ended up making the safe, prudent decision, which is not what I generally do and really not necessarily what I'm known for. But the circumstances were such that I just didn't feel that I could push it as much as I maybe normally would.
Well, and yeah, you factor all those other things into it. And you know, the safe, prudent decision was I think probably without a whole lot of question, the right decision, because like you said, if something goes wrong, you're not in a place that you're familiar with. The risk reward ratio for that situation probably was a bit askew from some of your normal other adventures that you've been on, where the risk might still be there, or the you know, the risk is still high, but there's, like you said, there's bailout points, there's people you can call, there's a cell signal you can access, or there's maps that you have. So, and you had a few other options if something did take a dramatic turn.
Yeah, exactly. And with something like this, I mean, I was trying to go do this double in 12 days, and I ended up turning around on day 7, which, if you figure, having done the route once, so I'd be doing a route I then knew on the way back with a lighter pack, I was basically right on time to hit 12 days purely unsupported, you know, which was exactly what I wanted to accomplish. I felt like 10 days was a pie in the sky goal for me, that if everything went really nicely, I could hit that. I thought 12 days was solid, and then 15 days was the established time for a double Drakensberg Grand Traverse. So I was on time to come in solidly under that. Yeah, I don't know. It still troubles me. It's gonna haunt me for a while. But I do know that the way it played out was that there was still like 2 more days of pretty rough weather, even down low, you know, even once I bailed out and was down at Bushman's Neck. Yeah. The weather stayed bad for like 2 more days. So it would have been pretty epic, and I'm sure I would have survived. I might have been able to push through. I think most likely I would have climbed back up to 10,000 feet and had a miserable night and ended up hiking back down and bailing out at Bushman's Neck anyway. So,
right.
But regardless, that's, you know, as horrible as those decisions are, being, you know, invested 6 days deep in an adventure and having traveled internationally and, you know, invested a bunch of money and garnered sponsor support to make it all happen, I love those moments, you know, having all of that on the line and facing this agonizing decision and trying to balance achievement and pushing your own personal limits and inspiring other people with risking your well-being and what you're, you know, with everything that's hanging in the balance. Those are great moments, you know?
Right.
I mean, even when they're horrible, even when you're making the decision you don't want to have to make, those are just these incredible moments to be in. They're so intense, and I get such a rush and just such an experience of being undeniably alive out of that. Even when it's making a heartbreaking decision, those are just amazing moments. And that's where I love to be. I obviously prefer when it goes my direction and right. I can thrust my arms in the air in victory and go home bragging on social media about what a cool thing I did. But realistically, most of the time, that's not the case. You know, mm-hmm. if somebody wanted to waste an afternoon on Google and go back and, you know, look at what I have and haven't accomplished and all of the stuff I've announced on the Fastest Known Time site, and then they had to sheepishly go back and say I failed at. I mean, my documented failures far outnumber my successes, you know. Mm-hmm. but that's great. You know, that's a big part of, you know, of what I've been working toward and attempting. And I really have to say, in a lot of ways, my list of fails is one of my big achievements.
Right. And I think that's a great segue into something else. I want just the idea of failing in general, because I think, you know, a lot of us that are listening, myself included, can't necessarily, at least right now, wrap our head around the idea of attempting, you know, some of the things that you've done, some of the yo-yo, some of the OKTs, some of the just the 200 mile races type of events. That's crazy. But I think all of us can relate on some level to the idea of setting a goal, of having a plan, and things not going the way we had hoped or expected or trained for, and having those failures, whether it's on race day, whether it's before that, whether it's an injury, whatever the case might be. Like you said, you've got a long list of failures, which means that you've tried a lot of things and sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't. But, you know, with that in mind, again, speaking for myself, speaking for I know some people that are listening, when you have that bad day or when things don't go according to plan, when you have a failure, it can be demoralizing. It can be, you know, heartbreaking. It can be something that really gets you down, depressing for a while before you bounce back. Do you have those struggles, or when something goes wrong and you have to bail out on a challenge or you know, the plan completely falls through and you have to scramble to find something different while you're on an airplane to South Africa, do you have those same sense of struggle and disappointment and loss, or is it just like, you know, I did what I could, it was the best situation, we did the planning, and you know, now it's life and let's try something different?
Yeah, I mean, I have all of that. You know, I'm a normal human being, so I have all the same fears, you know, fear of pain, fear of injury, fear of death, fear of failure. I go through all of that just like anybody does. But I guess I would maybe claim that I've trained myself to experience it a little differently, or to just kind of notice it as a marker. Mm-hmm. You know, fear is a huge driving force in humans. I think we really underestimate that animal drive and how much of our behavior is motivated by fear, even on just an everyday level, even in just like our social interactions and, you know, little decisions we make. Fear is a major driver in human beings. And for me, with the sort of adventures that I take on and just the way that I've lived my life for a long time, it was necessary for me to learn to recognize when I'm feeling fear and to be able to take a step back from that, you know, and sort of being outside of myself, outside of my immediate experience of whatever's causing me that fear, to be able to look at it and sort of reality test the situation, to step back and be like, okay, things aren't going how I want. There's this crazy weather moving in, which, you know, in maybe one, you know, 0.01% situation could kill me or put my life in jeopardy, whatever. But realistically, I'm just this little tiny hominid, you know, moving through the mountains of Lesotho, and it's just not as big a deal as it seems like. Mm. So to me, that's a big part of it, is learning to recognize when I'm afraid, when I'm feeling fear, and to be able to put that name on it and see it as what it is and evaluate the situation kind of dispassionately and understand, okay, I'm feeling fear and this is why. But when I look at the big picture, it's not as intense as it seems in that first person experience of it. But once something plays out, yeah, these failures do bother me. I love talking about them, and I do see them as badges to a great degree, because I've failed at things that the vast majority of people wouldn't even attempt. So even just the failure is a badge in a sense. But it's everything. I don't want to fail. I want to achieve these things. If I take on an adventure, it's because I've looked at it and my mind has grabbed onto it and chewed through all the logistics and decided that it's humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And then the question that fascinates me is whether or not I'm the human for whom it's possible. And if I try something, it's generally because I think, yes, I am the human for whom this is possible. So especially if I have a solid feeling that I can do a thing and then I'm unable to for one reason or another, it does bother me. It definitely bothers me, and it's definitely part of my motivation for the future as well. But it's also just what really engages me and fascinates me. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's kind of one of the differences maybe between race culture and trail culture, or between race, you know, the racing paradigm and an adventure paradigm. The way I see it, with a race, you're kind of shooting for a perfect performance. You're looking for everything to go right, and your training is based on peaking with this one perfect performance at a goal race, and maybe doing that a couple times in a year. But you're investing everything in trying to make all these factors fall into place so that you can have that one perfect performance. And like I said earlier, for me, an adventure really begins when, as soon as you can say things are not perfect. So as soon as things aren't perfect, it's like, okay, now this is an adventure. Now we've got to, you know, think on our feet. We've got to improvise solutions to this situation. We've got to look at our logistics and see if we have to reorganize something to make this go. That's what's kind of fascinating for me, is when things do start going wrong, even in just a minor way, seeing how we can move forward from there and where we can go and what we can do.
So when we talked last time, now, hopefully this isn't tearing off a scab or anything, but you're getting ready to go out on the Grand Enchantment Trail yo-yo attempt, which was another fail, and that one was you were in it for, I don't know, a long time. I don't remember how many days it was, but you were maybe
98 month, days,
yeah, months deep, and before you had to pull the plug on that. Are those type of adventures when they go sideways after you've invested that much, are those harder pill to swallow than something like this one, where it was 7 days before you had to pull the plug as opposed to 98? Or are each of them their own struggle to have to accept that things didn't go according to plan?
That's a good question. You know, they're really pretty similar. It's just time scale is kind of the difference between the two. So like the Double Drakensberg Grand Traverse attempt, that was only going to be 12 days, maybe 15, you know, mm-hmm. even at the outside. So it was a shorter time frame. So if things were going to go wrong, they were going to go wrong more quickly, mm-hmm. and decisions were going to be made more quickly. With the Grand Enchantment Trail yo-yo attempt, it played out on this large, slow time scale, where really things started going wrong almost from the beginning. And then it was this mathematical function, you know, watching the math just get worse and worse and worse as it stretched out over weeks and weeks. So you start off something like that thinking, okay, cool, you know, if everything goes perfect, we can maybe do this in 70 days, and 70 days is going to mean we bag 30 miles a day, you know. And then you get maybe a week in and you've had a couple of days where you only hit mileage in the teens and you got forced into your tent by a lightning storm early one day, you know, and all of a sudden you've only covered 23 miles a day for those first 7 days. And you look at the math and it's like, well, okay, 80 days is still on the table. We just have to hit 27 miles a day for the next 80, you know, for the next 70 days and we can bag that or whatever. So it was this whole experience of over weeks and weeks watching the math turn and reevaluating and resetting our goal and being like, okay, 90 days is still possible if we if we can hit this, or okay, well, you know, Kathy's lost a crazy amount of weight, we're going to have to take a 0 day in this little town and just eat and sleep for a couple nights, and then if we can hit 21 miles a day, we can still finish this in 100 days. You play these games like that where you keep figuring out ways to make it possible based on the new math and how things are turning. But at a certain point, it just isn't. And that's because we were doing this Southwest route. You know, the Southwest is just one of our favorite places to be. We love being in the deserts and mountains of Arizona and New Mexico and that whole region, southern Utah. But the realities of it are that summer is not a time you can be out on the trail. When it's 115 plus degrees and water sources are dried up, summer isn't a doable season. And winter, you've got snow and all the challenges of cold weather. So you're trying to bust these adventures out in a very short window. And so you can't just keep backing off a finish date interminably. There you have you know, you've got natural factors. You've got the natural world, which is going to set a firm boundary with you at a certain point. And on the GET, even though we just kept adjusting our goals and what we thought was possible and revising our plan on the fly, at 98 days, on day 97, we were just starting to get hit with the blistering heat. We still had 300 miles to go. And we made this crazy push trying to get through. We hiked through the night because it was getting so hot during the day that we just moved all night long, with our plan being to find some deep shade, like in a cliff face, and sleep during the day and move during the cool of the night. And we just weren't able to find deep enough shade, and it kept moving. We were in this place where we couldn't entirely choose our location, and it just didn't go. And we basically knew that things were coming to an end when during that break, Kathy accidentally left her sleeping pad in the direct sun for a couple minutes and it melted.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good clue to get off the trail at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it really just was like, and then we went through this, I won't go into too many details, because Kathy can tell you about that, but we went just through this whole agonizing process basically that afternoon and realized that it wasn't going to go, that we had to make that call. And then once we got off the trail, we found out that the trail just a little bit further west of there, that the big wildfire had started and the trail was closed. And whether we had made that decision or not, we weren't going to be able to complete the route.
Gotcha. Does that make it, I don't want to say easier, but does that make it feel like slightly less of a failure because ultimately you wouldn't have been able to complete it anyway, or is it still just something that eats at you?
Yeah, no, it doesn't make it any less of a failure.
I didn't figure.
It's still something that eats at me in a couple of ways. I mean, because one is you can take all of that math that we were doing at the time, you know, and you can go back and mess with that and be like, oh, if we'd taken two less 0 days, then we would have been another 60 miles along the trail and we would have been past the fire before it broke out. You know, there's all those what ifs that you can use to torture yourself. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make it any easier, but it's not all that horrible either. I mean, I do enjoy going back and mentally reworking those adventures and trying to see what we could have done differently, where we could have made these little changes that would have just gotten us another mile a day, you know, and over the course of 98 days, another mile a day puts you 100 miles further along. It's a big difference. So that's a big part of what fascinates me about doing this anyway. So I can use the time machine in my head to go back and change things and see how it would have played out, but I don't have a real one I can hop in. So
right.
It'll always bother me a little bit, but not necessarily in a bad way.
Do you, when you have one of the fails or something that doesn't go well and you have to abort mission, do you often go back and try it again? Or with something, I mean, you know, going to South Africa, like that's a obviously a lot bigger trip than something that's a little bit more local. So maybe that's a one time only. But then something like GET, I mean, that's a huge, like you said, 3 months and lots of logistics and planning and the whole nine yards. How often do you try something again, or is it either works or it doesn't for you?
It depends. It depends on how resonant the project is with me and with all the logistics involved. The GET yo-yo, I mean, that was big because that was such a huge fail. It wasn't just that project, but that was the second part of a big four-part desert yo-yo project that we were working on. So we had yo-yoed the Arizona National Scenic Trail like a year and a half before that and been the first people to do that. And during that hike, we had the idea of trying to yo-yo these four desert trails or routes that are all about 800 miles long, none of which had ever been yo-yoed before. And we were planning on doing them in the ascending order of difficulty. So the Grand Enchantment Trail was the one that we thought was going to be the second most difficult, and that was what we were on. But so failing that was actually failing this whole big project that we'd not only announced on social media and, you know, to sponsors, but had talked about in, you know, all across Arizona in a speaking tour. I mean, it was a very big public fail of what was supposed to be a years-long project. So I don't know. Right now, we don't have any plans to attempt another GET yo-yo and try to finish off that project. I can't absolutely say no. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully we have decades of adventuring ahead of us during which we could go back and attempt that again. So I'm certainly not going to say absolutely not, but it's just so we keep moving forward. And so since that didn't go, we have other adventures and other projects in mind that we're focused on now, and we're probably going to prioritize. We're definitely going to prioritize attempting those first. So we'll just see. We'll see if the GET yo-yo comes around again in a couple of years, or if someone else goes out and busts one out, or what happens.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, a lot of the time with adventures and things like this, we'll have just all these ideas going, and it's a matter of kind of just pushing on things and seeing which things go. So a lot of the time I'll have even a couple different adventures set for a time frame, and I just see which things come together. Like that happened with the Harvey Manning Challenge, which was a roughly 100-mile long peak bagging challenge in the Issaquah Alps that I did with Seth Wolpen earlier this year. And I had actually been trying to put together there's the Izzy Alps 100 route that George Orozco designed, which is essentially a route through the Issaquah Alps, which is a mountain range just outside Seattle, very close to Seattle. But this route he put together is essentially equivalent to Hard Rock, except that it's not at elevation. But the amount of elevation gain in the route is about the same as Hard Rock. And I was the first person to do it unsupported, and I think the only person to do it in the winter so far. But I wanted to do a double, so I was trying to set up pacers to help me do a double Izzy Alps 100. And a good friend, Vaughn Fawn, who's just an epic, legendary ultra runner in the Pacific Northwest, she was doing, I can't remember, her fourth or fifth Izzy Alps, I think, and we have a lot of the same friends, so she had actually used up the whole pacing pool of the people we know that are the caliber and the experience with that route. I kept checking with people, and they're like, oh, I'm pacing Vaughn on Saturday. Oh, I'm pacing Vaughn on Thursday. Oh, no, I'm set up to pace Vaughn on Friday. So I was actually trying to push that project, and that wasn't going. And then I stopped by Seth's house to talk to him. He travels internationally, and we're trying to get a hold of some medication for Giardia. So we stopped by to talk to him about that, and he told me that he'd been scouting out the Harvey Manning Challenge. And I said, well, hey, if you know you've done all the legwork, you know that I'm good for the distance and effort. If you want a last minute company on that, just let me know. So that ended up happening. So long story, just as long, no shorter. It's I often have a bunch of things that I'm just kind of pushing on and seeing what goes, seeing what works, you know, what continues forward. And so if a second GET yo-yo attempt moves forward at some point, then we'll go with it.
It is wow. There's so many other questions I have and things we could talk about, but at some point we're going to have to wrap this thing up, and we're getting close to that that hour mark. So might as well try to find a spot pretty soon, which just begs to, you know, do this again at some point down the road when you have more adventures to talk about and whatnot. And I would love that opportunity. But the way I want to wrap things up today, Ross, if you're okay with it, is to kind of ask what actually I had written down as the possible altered introductory question, but when he told me about the road marathon and all of that good stuff, that went right out the window right from the beginning. But maybe we'll use that to wrap things up today. And I'd just be curious, of all the different challenges that you've attempted, the ones that have gone well, the ones that have gone off the rails, you know, just all of the adventures and the things that you've done, at this point, looking back on the places you've been, the challenges you've done, the adventures you've had, which one seems to just kind of stand out in your mind as like, as something where you're just like, wow, like even, you know, you're still surprised that you did it, surprised that you attempted it, or it was just the most memorable for whatever reason. What is kind of your favorite, adventure that you've been on at this point in your life?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. I've done such a variety of projects. That's very difficult to answer because there's so much, you know, apples to oranges to eggplants to pineapples.
Well, you know, when it's your first time on the show, we throw you softballs. When you get to your third time on here, like, you know, we come with the hard asking questions here.
Yeah, you know, the GET yo-yo was such an amazing experience, even though it was a fail. I mean, Kathy and I have been calling that the greatest fail of our lives, just because it was so epic, and it was such a wonderful experience, even all the horror of it. So it's hard not to say that, but I guess, you know, as far as the way you framed the question with being amazed that I was able to do a thing, you know, something that I'm still kind of surprised that I was even involved in it, I guess I would have to say the Mount Rainier Infinity Loop. So that was a couple years ago, or last year, I guess, Gavin Woody and I did a route called the Mount Rainier Infinity Loop. And I mean, Mount Rainier is really the one geographic feature that I can credit with making me who and what I am. If it wasn't for Mount Rainier and for the Wonderland Trail around the base of it, I don't think I'd be doing any of these things. I mean, that was hiking the Wonderland Trail, which is only a 93-mile trail around the base of the mountain. That was what basically started everything years ago when I was 260 pounds and could barely even hike a mile without being out of breath and hunched over on the side of the trail, clutching my spasming back. Kathy had the idea of through hiking the Wonderland, and we ended up doing that as a family with our 7-year-old daughter. It took us 21 days the first time to do 93 miles, you know, which if you want to do the math, there's nothing impressive there. But that was what just, you know, ignited this spark in our hearts and made us realize that was where we were the most alive and were most ourselves and where we wanted to be was out on the trail. So 15 years later, Mount Rainier Infinity Loop was a dream project of the iconic Seattle mountaineer Chad Kellogg. And unfortunately, he died on Mount Fitzroy in Patagonia before he was ever able to attempt the project. But what he had dreamed of doing was traversing the summit of Mount Rainier, so basically climbing up one side of the summit, climbing down the other side, running back to the start on the Wonderland, then traversing the summit again via the same route, and then running back to the start the opposite direction, so that it would essentially form a figure eight or an infinity sign, including, you know, the circumambulation of the mountain and the two summits of it. So that was upwards of 50,000 feet of elevation gain over, I can't remember now, about 120 miles, including, you know, glacier travel, not real technical mountaineering as such, but glacial travel so that you're carrying a harness and, you know, enough gear for self-rescue or to pull your partner out of a crevasse if necessary. So, yeah, looking back on that and with it being Chad's dream project, I still can't believe that Gavin and I were the first people to complete that route or that I was even involved in a project of that magnitude. That still blows my mind.
Yeah, it's I mean, obviously, to me, they all blow my mind. But I know for myself, you know, like there's things that I've done that people are like, wow, I can't believe you did that. And like, I'm not anything fancy. But then there's always those one or two things for me that just kind of stick out my mind. And like, that was a pretty cool thing. So I knew that there had to be a couple things for you that probably were in that boat. And, you know, we could probably talk for a couple of days on just some of the cool things on the things like, I couldn't believe I did that at this point. And like, this was cool for this reason, all that kind of stuff. But I knew that would be a tough one. But I'm glad you're willing to play ball a little bit there. So thanks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, and that trip too, like Gavin, he coined a term for that. He called it ultraneering because we were combining ultra distance travel with mountaineering, you know, and that's what fascinates me is these gray areas, you know, where like the land in between easy definitions of disciplines. Mm. So something like that, an ultraneering project, yeah, that just gets my brain firing on all cylinders. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity to even mention that, and maybe just hearing this funky new word, ultraneering, you know, that's going to land in somebody's mind and that's going to spark some ideas. It'll be, you know, interesting to see maybe 5 or 10 years down the road, you might be interviewing somebody else who's done something crazy and be like, yeah, you know, on your show a decade ago, I heard this word ultraneering and I was like, oh, that's a fascinating portmanteau. What can I do in that game? You know?
Oh, I that would be awesome if that were to happen. I plan on still being here a decade down the road. So whoever's listening to this and is inspired, let's make it happen. And we'll reference back to this episode somewhere, you know, a decade or so down the line. But Ross,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, just thanks again for taking the time and coming back always exciting to talk about the wins. But I think sometimes it's important to talk about the things that don't go according to plan. And I mean, they happen to all of us and thank you just for being willing to crack that open and crack that nut you know, just talk about it and be honest that, yeah, it still sucks when things happen that aren't according to plan and you fail on an adventure, but just keep moving forward. So I encourage you to continue to do that as well. I know you don't need my encouragement. You're going to keep doing it, but certainly looking forward to continuing to follow along and see what the future holds. And guys, again, ultrapedestrian.com is the website. You can find them all over the social medias. We'll have everything linked up in the show notes, dizruns.com/519 for this one. So Ross, thanks again. Take good care. Have a great and blessed and prosperous and successful 2018. And I'll certainly be looking forward to continue to follow along and see what the future holds for you. And looking forward to doing this again at some point down the road.
Hey, thank you so much, Denny. It's always a blessing to talk to you. And thanks for putting this podcast out. You know, you may not get a lot of feedback from people. You may not know it, but by putting the vibes out there that you're doing and spreading the word, you are inspiring people. And there are people that are going out and doing things they wouldn't have done otherwise, whether it's going for a half mile walk around the block or signing up for a half marathon or an ultra or whatever it may be. You know, there's this great circle of mutual inspiration that we all get to be a part of. And podcasts like yours are an important mechanism in spreading that. So thanks for everything that you do for the community.
I appreciate that, my friend. Be well.
Take care. Blessings.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to today's episode of the show. Hope that you enjoyed a little round three action with my friend Roz today. And as always, I'd be curious to know what stood out to you from this episode. What was your takeaway from our conversation today? For me, I think it really just comes down to the idea of always moving forward, no matter what. You know, we're all going to fail from time to time. You know, whether that's some, you know, long drawn out plan, like an epic yo-yo crossing of the Grand Enchantment Trail, like Ross and Kathy, you know, had earlier last year, or whether it's just missing a goal, you know, oversleeping, you know, coming up short on race day or having a bad workout. We all have those various failures at different points in our running lives and our running careers, and shoot, beyond running, we have those failures as well. And what really differentiates, in my mind at least, the you know what allows us to succeed ultimately is our ability to let go of the failures and keep moving forward. It's not always easy, you know, and if it's a big epic, you know, something that you really put a lot of time and effort and energy into, and things don't turn up the way you want, it can eat at you for a while, and that's okay. But you still have to keep moving forward. Now, you know, that may mean that you come back and try it again. It may mean that you move on to the next thing. But I know that I've struggled in the past, and maybe you have as well, of kind of living in the past a little bit, of allowing, you know, a past defeat or a past failure to haunt me on multiple occasions. And that's certainly not a good place to be. So when we have those bad days, when we have those races that definitely don't go according to plan, when we're dealing with an injury or whatever it might be, the quicker that you can move past it and focus on the next thing, focus on the next target out in front of you and move forward towards that, the better. And, you know, for somebody like Ross and anybody who tries anything big, anything epic, anything that's never been done before, you know, the failure rate is going to be high. So you have to be willing to just keep moving forward. And that was just the big takeaway that I got from today is that, you know, my failures may not be quite on the scope of others, of Ross especially, but I'm going to have my struggles. I'm going to have my moments when things definitely don't go according to plan. And all I can do is when that happens, keep moving forward. Keep moving forward to the next thing. So that was my takeaway. What about you? What stood out to you from this episode? Let me know. Shoot me a tweet at DizRuns. Shoot me an email, DizRuns@gmail.com. And as always, you can head to the show notes for this episode or any episode and leave a comment there. And the show notes for this episode are DizRuns.com/519. Leave a comment there and let me know what you thought of this episode. What was your takeaway? What stood out to you from what we talked about today? And that is that's about it. That's where we're going to wrap things up for today. Don't forget, if you want a one-off coaching call, we've got those. There's no, I'm not going to try to sell you into a coaching program or anything like that. I'm just going to try to help you navigate through whatever struggle you're dealing with. And if you want to set one of those up, DizRuns.com/consultation. Get that set up and we will try to help you out and get you back on track and maybe help you get over one of your failures and keep moving forward to the next thing. Maybe that's part of what you need. DizRuns.com/consultation, one-off coaching calls available whenever you need them. Just schedule them and real easy. It takes one step to schedule. You know, back and forth. Get it set up and we'll move forward. So with that, we'll go ahead and officially put a bow on this thing now. Thank you guys for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, pass it along, will you? Tell a friend about the show. Post about it, blog about it, whatever it might be, whatever your method of communication is in the digital world. If you don't mind doing a little sharing, a little bit of promotion, it certainly helps me out and it's very much appreciated. So please be well. Please take good care. Thank you again for listening. And until next time, be well. All right. Take care, guys. Talk soon.